Hey everyone, welcome back to the Neon Eon, your hopefully favorite podcast about 90s country music. I'm your host, music journalist Thomas Mooney. So this week's episode is actually an older episode that I had done on my other podcast called New Slang, which if you're into Americana stuff, go ahead and hit that subscribe for that podcast. I promise though, there are three really, really, really great reasons why I'm running it here on the old Neon Eon. One, it is with Clint Black, and who doesn't want to hear Clint Black talk about music? Two, it's really the episode and the interview that kind of set this whole thing in motion. After speaking with Clint, it became super apparent that I should try and do an entire show, a spinoff, if you will, just about the 90s country era. And finally, while things didn't work out just right on the logistics for a handful of guests, basically, I couldn't get them worked in early enough for it to run for this week. I do want to ease your mind, though. Those guests, they didn't just full out cancel on the Neon Eon or anything. We just couldn't get them worked in. Super busy schedules. At any rate, this interview with Clint, it's really been one of my favorites that I've ever done. And I think you're going to really enjoy it because he gives so much insight to the era. I'm going to make this intro super, super quick. But first, one, share and subscribe the Neon Eon. If you're over on iTunes, give the show a 5-star review. Two, there's plenty of avenues to follow the Neon Eon social media-wise. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, all at The Neon Eon. Three, there are two really great Neon Eon playlists that I have going over on Spotify. One, it's basically every top 10 song that charted during the 90s. And the other is focused on the songwriters behind a lot of these incredible songs. So go follow those if you would like. Four, go ahead and check out the Patreon while you're at it. It's a great way to help support this podcast, as well as to get some extra bonus content like merch and so on. And finally, any and all the links for the things that I just mentioned, they will be in the show notes for easy access. All right, let's quit killing time and get on into the interview. Here is Clint Black. I guess I want to start off with is one of my favorite records is obviously like your debut record, Killin' Time. It came out just over 30 years ago. 30 years ago was last year, the 30th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, like those songs are 30 plus years old. You probably don't think about it as those years go by, but when you hit a milestone like that. What did you do? Did you kind of like have a little bit of a reflection moment just to kind of appreciate and go, wow?
Yeah, the wow factor is there. And my manager and I were talking about what do we do, to commemorate. And he was talking about some events and things like that. I remember just thinking, I don't want to try to make too big a deal out of it other than to, celebrate, the milestone of 30 years in this business making music. And so for me, it became more evolved into more of not about that first album, but about the entirety of that 30 years and what all I've done. And as I started thinking about that, I'd never wanted to do a live album. I really felt like they detracted from what a live show experience was like. And so I was against it anytime anyone brought it up. But I always record my shows we have Pro Tools out there. So I'm recording and I use those as, work tapes if I need them. But never thought of them as anything to put out. And then it hit me one day, if I were ever going to release a live album, this would be the time. And if this goes by, what's another reason to release one? And so I started warming to the idea. And I had, several approaches, one of which was, what if I did, all the songs off that album. And then I thought, you know, again, it really is about the 30 years and not just looking back to that moment. So if I take songs, you know, that I've been doing on the road, then maybe the best thing is just to take a snapshot of who we are playing those songs. Because half the band was with me when I, you know, was making the demos and getting the record deal. So let's take a snapshot at this point in time, 30 years later, some of the songs from that first album and some of the other songs from the 30 years. And then it really started to feel good and right. And, you know, I had my engineer pull some recordings and look for the ones that were the best technically, and we had a good night. And so we found and earmarked some songs and said, all right, well, let's make it about these songs. And then I said, well, you know, if I'm going to do a live album, I want it to really be live. You know, I'm not going to re-sing any of it. So we really have to find a good night and, you know, where all of the gear worked and, you know, no glitches. So we did that. And then there were only, you know, there were two songs where the fiddle recording had been corrupted. And so I had my fiddle player just come in and do one pass just like he would on the road. And then we, you know, replaced those parts that were digitally corrupted. And so it was a live album. And real and authentic and all of that. And I felt good about it. But I had these two songs that one I'd written before I met Hayden, my lead guitarist, and who I wrote, you know, half of my hits with. And one other song that he and I wrote that would have gone on Killing Time were it not for Walking Away, which is a waltz, a three-quarter. And so this old house was three-quarter signature. So I didn't want to have two of those on the same album. So Walking Away beat out This Old House, and This Old House got pushed aside, and it got pushed aside again and again until it was forgotten. And I was looking back through everything over my career and all of the songs, and I found these two songs. And I asked my manager, I said, would it be weird to have two studio tracks on this? And he loved the idea. We all chewed on it for a while and decided that would be good. They're songs from that era. They could have easily been on Killing Time, but for other songs that went on instead. So let's do it. And that really was, I think, the entirety of what we did to commemorate this milestone.
Yeah. It's always interesting to, I feel like as a fan or as a journalist, you know, we get the finished product, but like that's just like the tip of that iceberg of what was going on for that moment in time for the artist, you know? And so like those other songs, the songs that ended up on the cutting floor or weren't recorded or, you know, even just stuff that's was halfway finished, that adds so much context to that moment in your life. And I always love when artists will do that, go and revisit and show those other little moments that could have, you know, taken place in an alternative history.
Yeah. I've listened to those Beatles tracks where they're talking about, either back then or they're reflecting on that moment. And I love hearing that. It's, you know, it's something I would probably do if this lockdown dragged on for much longer, I might get around to doing stuff like that. You know, sometimes I feel like I just don't even remember what in the world we were thinking when we wrote that song. So what am I going to say? And, you know, but, it's, you know, for me looking back, the things that I'm going to reflect on and remember, if you say 1989, the first thing that's going to come to mind for me is the craziest time of my life, trying to adjust to jumping onto a train doing 90 and maintaining, you know, my sense of self and well-being. And, you know, everywhere I went was an event or surrounding me. And there were very few times in my life back then where it wasn't some kind of an event. They're just, if I had a day or a week off, which was rare, I wasn't going anywhere doing anything, you know, nothing but the couch. And so most of my life was consumed with trying to balance, how I think of myself and how everyone is seeing me and treating me. And so I look back over those years and I know it was harried and crazy. And I'd like to think I handled it well. But as I go from 89 to 95, I look back on 89 from 95 and I go, yeah, I wasn't handling it that well. It was crazy. And then, but now I'm handling it really well. And then when I look back on 95 from like 2000 and I'm going, yeah, I was still wasn't handling it that well. It was still crazy in 1995. And then, so now in 2020, looking back on all those years, I know just how crazy it was at times and how displaced, you know, you can feel where this is what I dreamed of and it's what I'm wanted to do and what I'm going to do and what I want to still do. But there's still a mourning for the loss of something that you used to have, whether you want what you have now or not. And I remember after Killing Time, I remember going back to my old neighborhood, one of my trips back home, Houston, and driving just by coincidence past a bar I used to play in as a soloist, just me and my guitar and no band. And I remember driving past that bar and going, oh, there's that. It was just a little dump in a dive in a strip center, you know, nobody in there cared that I was playing. And I remember the feeling it struck me like, realizing at that moment that I've crossed a line, that I'll never be able to go into that bar again and be the same person I was when nobody cared that I was playing. And there's a sense of accomplishment and a sense of loss all at once. And I know it's hard for anyone who's dreaming of making it in this business to probably understand how there can be any remorse, you know, that goes along with your success. But it is like a death. You know, I've always been the guy playing in the bar who's watching people and what they do and seeing what their behavior and looking for an idea for a song and all of that stuff. That was gone. And I knew it. Instinctively at a crossing, going past that bar, I knew I'm in a new life now, and that life will never be the same.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Like it's one of those things where, you know, in a flash, you can't just go out to hang out with a buddy at a bar anymore. You know, it's.
Well, you can, but you're carrying new weights.
Yeah,
you know, you have new responsibilities. It's not just you anymore. It's you and everyone's feelings you're going to affect if you don't treat them just right. And when you're in a bar, especially somebody who's been drinking all night, their definition of treating them right and mine might be a little different.
Yeah. It's, you know, I've heard some people, like some fans say, you know, that an artist is all their job is quote unquote, you know, that 90 minutes on stage or whatever. And I'm like, no, that's absolutely not the case. Cause if you run into Clint Black at the grocery store, you have to be Clint Black in that moment too. It's not just the on stage or the show night or whatever. You're that person forever from that point on. You have to have your quote unquote Clint Black, the artist.
Yeah, and there's no training for it. And there's a responsibility, you know, if you care how people feel. And I mean, if I weren't anyone famous, I would still feel the same way. I don't like to hurt people's feelings. Mm-hmm. And if someone has loved my music and suddenly they're meeting me for the first time, you know, I remember when I met Clint Eastwood for the first time, you know, how he treated me would have mattered a lot. You know, if I would have caught him in the middle of walking from one thing to another, and, you know, then you look at it differently than, you know, how people you like, treat you, you know, you have a responsibility to their feelings. You know, it's sort of a weird thing, but I think if you're someone who likes people in general, you'd never want to hurt their feelings anyway. And lots of people I've met are very, very reasonable. They understand that you can't stop and talk to them for 20 minutes. Maybe you have somewhere to be, and you know, and they appreciate your any of your time. You know, thanks for stopping, you know, and saying hi, and let me tell you something. You know, and then there are other people who, you know, and it's rare, who will not be satisfied with just a moment of your time. They will resent anything less than everything they want out of that moment. And those are that's when you really feel it's kind of crushing sometimes, and then it's my feelings, because I feel like there really isn't enough I can do for you to make you feel good, and so now I feel bad. I've had fans say or do something that made it feel like they weren't looking at me as a human anymore, and or someone who they respected that I had to go from A to B, and you know, I'm on my way to a doctor's appointment, and a quick hello is great, but I got to go, you know, and they don't respect that. And so then, you know, you really have to try extra hard to make sure you don't make somebody feel bad or dissatisfied with the moment, because then it starts to flow back on you. Now I feel bad, and it's a, you know, James Taylor, I'm a big James Taylor fan. And he has a lyric, fortune and fame, such a curious game. Perfect strangers will call you by name. Pay good money to hear fire and rain again and again and again. And you know, it's summer like summer, coming back every year. Got your baby, got your blanket, got your bucket of beer. I break into a grin from ear to ear, and suddenly it's perfectly clear. That's why I'm here. And I always set out to be an entertainer, make music people loved, and treat people nicely. But I never, you know, I wasn't like Garth. I won't go 29 hours without peeing so that you know I care. I will go to the bathroom when my bladder's about to explode. I need you to know that, you know, I will go to the bathroom when I really have to go, and assume that you're going to know I still care, you know? So certain people appreciate that, and some people don't. And you know, I asked George Strait once when I was just getting going, I said, how do you do it? How do you, you're going in and you're playing for thousands of people, and you have to head out the door to the airport, and there's a bunch of people out back, and you can't stop. How do you go past them? And forget exactly what he said, but he had a great answer, you know, and it was basically, you just have to do what you can for people when you have time, and, you know, let it go.
Yeah. It's really interesting that something you said a minute ago about how it can affect where you kind of get songs from. So many of your songs, you know, you have that, what I would call kind of like you've taken and put a spotlight on like the Wallflower, I feel like a lot of these songs feel like you are very insightful to the people on the outside, their feelings, right? And, you know, so much of that is you can get from is from people watching. And when you go from being the someone who's able to watch to being where that spotlight is on you, that I think that's it's incredibly insightful. Did you feel you had to like it changed the way you wrote songs, or did you just have to be a little bit more I guess careful or like more attentive to where those moments came where you're able to people watch or get thoughts?
I continue to be a student of human behavior. I still had lots of people around me, lots to witness. But I also would read books, you read books, watch movies, documentaries. I would read psychology books, when psychologists would put out a book that would become a bestseller and suddenly everybody knows about it. Oh, I'm going to read that book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People or something like that, And I read that book and there was a line in there where the author was suggesting that our relationships would be a lot better off if we treated love as a verb instead of a noun. So that went into my brain, and 5 years later out came love isn't something that we have, it's something that we do. So mm-hmm. the observation kept going. It just, I was just in a different world looking out at it.
Yeah, that's one of those songs where I guess like when you growing up, I guess, I've heard it a million times, but then that one day where it really clicked, it clicked and you're like, oh yeah, this is exactly what he's talking about now. And it's not just a good sound.
Desperado was that way. I sang Desperado in the bars for years, and then I recorded it on the Common Thread album, Eagles Tribute. Mm-hmm. And then I was out performing it on the road, for crowds of thousands of people. And one night I'm up there singing it, and it was like, there's this new moment in my life where a lyric in that song that had always meant something to me suddenly means something else also, because of the context and the life I'm living now. And even songs of my own, I'll be singing on stage and trying to feel them. And something will pop into my head, and it'll be a new thought, a new look at my own thought. It's a funny thing.
Yeah, it is interesting to see how time, obviously attaches itself to songs, but then also kind of can help morph and change them. And depending on the day you listen to them, you're going to catch something. And what I find incredibly interesting is when it does that with a songwriter too, is when they, they wrote it about this moment in their life, but then now they have a different feel to it, and they can still like feel that initial feeling, but then also like, oh yeah, this is what also this means too, or
because we evolve. And the thing that popped into my head when you're saying that is I think it was a Russian who said it, if you don't love it, if you're 20 and you don't love Russia or whatever, you have no heart. If you're 40 and you do, you have no brain. It was one of those things where, and it may have been about socialism or something, cause we're young, we're idealistic. We see the way that everything can be. We know we have it figured out, and then you find out 20 years later, well, I didn't have it all figured out. It's called maturing, where I look now as a father at my own father differently. I understand things that he did more clearly now than ever, even though at the time I knew what he was doing and why he was doing it, why he was punishing me or whatever, why, you know, he would or wouldn't let me have the car keys, you know, whatever it was. But until you've lived a little more, you know, you can only see part of it. I told my daughter when she was a lot younger, she's 19, but I told her when she was much younger, and I was trying to teach her something. I said, you're like if an alien was dropped onto this planet 9 years ago. So she was nine. I said, you're like if an alien was dropped onto this planet 9 years ago, and you're trying to understand how everything works, learn the language, learn what to watch out for, and all of that. And I was dropped here 58 years ago, you know, or 50 years ago, whatever it was. I know my way around, you know, I don't have all the answers, but I know my way around. And when I was dropped on here, it had been firing on all pistons for 100,000 years of civilization or whatever it is. And I said, so it's really important for you to stick close to and learn from somebody who was dropped onto the planet 50 years ago, because I've seen a few things and I can warn you about them and show you some ways to have a lot of fun, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that's kind of how you come to this evolution of, you know, I don't see my song in the same way anymore. I have songs that I've written where I just don't even agree with what I said. I don't like what I said necessarily, or it just doesn't say it quite as well.
Yeah. Well, like, obviously, like, you've written basically everything that you've recorded. For country music, for just music in general, you learn that there are songwriters out there who write songs, and there's really great artists who can translate that for the public and cover those songs really well. Obviously, you know, here in country music, you know, there is a lot of really great song interpreters, but you know, when you dive into the liner notes, the one thing you notice with Clint Black is that he's written like 99% of the songs he's recorded. Was that ever anything that you was something that you wanted to be a staple of your career, is that you were a songwriter as well?
Absolutely, yeah. There's only one song that I recorded that I didn't write. If you don't count cover songs like Desperado, the Waylon song, or the Monty Python Galaxy song, mm-hmm. Everything else I've written. One song I recorded around 2007 called "The Strong One," I didn't write, and the record company, my company, asked, you know, let's do an experiment and let's just meet with the publishers and have them all pitch you a song and see if there's one song we can find that you would record as an outlier, you know. And so I did it. But when I was growing up, I read the liner notes. My dad showed me, look, here's where the artist's name is, and here's the writer of the song, and here's the producer, usually Billy Sherrill if it's good. And so that's, you know, my dad educating me. And from that point on, I read liner notes. And I noticed sorry, hang on one second. Let me try to get this noise away. So I'm reading the liner notes, and I'm noticing that a lot of the artists I listen to wrote their own songs. James Taylor, Jimmy Buffett, Loggins and Messina, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings. Waylon recorded a lot of outside songs, and so did Willie, but the Eagles, you know, and on and on and on. And I started to realize that I gravitated more toward them. And that's what I wanted to be. And then I remember before I got my record deal, I was watching listening to an interview with Reba, and she was saying, well, I listened to probably 1,000 songs to pick 10 for an album. And I thought, whoa, that sounds really hard. And I thought, man, I don't know if I want to try to keep myself out of that position. It's if I can write them. And so when I got my record deal, I told Hayden, Nicholas, I said, if I get my way, I'm going to get real busy really soon. So we need to start writing for the second and third album now. So as a result of that, every time I went in to make another album, I always had about 30 songs written. And that's how songs like This Old House and No One Here For Me get pushed aside, because new stuff's constantly coming in. And so I never had a shortage of songs, but when I got to around my fourth album, After the Hard Way, the record company started pressuring me to record outside songs. And, you know, my attitude was, well, wait a minute, you know, I think I did a pretty good job on the other ones. And, you know, I didn't understand. So I didn't, and I recorded the No Time to Kill album, and we had 5 hits off of that. And then I recorded the One Emotion album, and we had 5 hits off of that. And then I went in to cut 2 songs to have as additions to my first greatest hits album. And Like the Rain was one of them. And the head of the label didn't like my second verse. And I went to talk to Stroud, my co-producer, and I said, what do you think I should do? He said, you know what? He's the head of your record company, and it's so easy for you to write a verse. Just write another second verse. So I did, and I recorded that and sent it along, and word came back that he loved it, had my label. So I went in to talk to him, and I said, listen, I hope you know that I want to be, you know, the strongest adhesive in this relationship. And I like the spirit of cooperation. And that's why I, you know, wrote a new second verse. I said, but I need to understand why it's so important. The pressure to record outside songs had grown more and more and more, even with the hits of Bad Goodbye, Good Brother Bad Luck, State of Mind, No Time to Kill, you know, Summer's Coming, all of that. You know, I was having a lot of hits. And even in the face of that, the pressure for me to record songs written by Nashville, you know, songwriters, et cetera, was growing. The pressure was becoming pretty intense. And I said, I just need to understand why it's so important. And he said, they just want a little taste.
Mm-hmm.
My heart sank. I thought, tell me my songs really aren't that good, even though they're selling something, but that this is about sharing revenue with publishing companies and writers in this town. And that's your reason to come after my life's work. Not good enough. Not good enough. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. I went on and I recorded the Nothing But the Taillights album and wrote everything on it and de-electrified. I did 4 cover songs and wrote everything else on it. And when I said I do, been there, you know, had hits all along the way. And then whenever I left RCA, I met with a couple of major record companies, and they wanted to sign me. Really happy to, but not if I insist on writing my own songs. And so I did an independent record, and then some major labels wanted to sign me after that. And so I met with 3 different labels over about a 3-year period, each one going through like a courtship. And each time they wanted me and everything about me. And by the end of it, they said, but, you know, if you just wouldn't insist on writing your own songs. And I thought, man, this is just, your company, buddy, you can do with your company what you want, but no, I'm not signing up for any of this. So here I am today. I'm an indie artist. I put out my own records on my own label. I have a distribution deal with a subsidiary of one of the major labels. I don't have any kind of a promotion team out promoting my records at radio, but I'm doing the best work of my life. And that's in the end what I'll be most proud of, where the record sales and awards are exciting, and they bring a lot of revenue to the artists. If impacted my life's work for the sake of that, I would not be happy. I would not be happy today. And so I really had to, it was a great point of contention, but it was really after my first album, they tried to get me to record some outside songs, and I said, I've got plenty. And I didn't hear anything else about it. But I thought, you know, the guy who wrote that Killing Time album, probably you ought to let him keep his job. It's kind of the way I looked at it.
Yeah. Well, you know, what it sounds like is at that point, it's not about, it's the commercialization of art, right? It's not about the actual
commerce,
art.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just sounds like, you know, that's where you're at a loss, you know, like those people have lost the forest for the trees, you know? And, you know, I always kind of look back at when talking with, you know, friends who are young songwriters, and is like, you know, after this is all done, people are going to look at your work and realize, you know, like, oh, you know, this is, they're able to take it all at once and realize that there is the, I guess I have like one buddy who had a line about, his name is John Bauman, and it's, too late to quit, or too soon for accolades and too late to quit. And just kind of about, you know, it's, at some point you'll get your accolades. At some point people will praise you for the stuff you've done, you know, even if you think it's too late at the time, you know, so.
Well, you know, I appreciate that one, but I won't say his name. I don't, you know, hadn't gotten his blessing to do so, but someone my brother knows, who's one of the all time great songwriters, one I greatly respect, said, hey, I just decided one day that I was going to go through your brother's entire catalog and just see what kind of songwriting he has done. And his assessment was very flattering. And that meant more to me than any award. I really feel like it's the work that I enjoy, and the rewards wouldn't be nearly enough if I didn't enjoy the work. Mm-hmm. And it's too hard to make a record. It's 10, 12 hours a day, and it gets inside you like an earworm, and it takes over your life. And, you know, I think about, you know, Jackson Pollock, you know, you get to a point where you're so consumed by it that I can't even stand in the kitchen and have a conversation, because the music won't stop in my head. And Lisa knows, you know, after all these years, she'll go, you didn't hear any of that, did you? And I go, no. She goes, go back to work or whatever. You know, it reminds me of a funny line where the wife says, you're not listening to a word I'm saying, are you? And I thought to myself, what a weird way to start a conversation. You know, it's a lot of work, and to dedicate that work to somebody else's work, I couldn't do it. I've been offered jobs, you know, and television and movies, and I look at it and I say, you know, I can't do that 10 hours a day. I can't, you know, would pay well, would put me in a good light, but I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still putting in hours and hours. I put in hours every day practicing on my guitar. You know, I'll watch, you know, guitar lessons on YouTube and try to get my brain to see things I can't see. You know, I'm still very, very active, very driven. I have learned how to engineer just about anything I want to engineer, except I still hire an engineer for tracking sessions and mixing. You know, but I can run my entire studio, need be, and usually will, and I can do it 10, 12 hours a day. And, you know, I can't imagine just saying, well, you know, you can do half your job, but you can't do your whole job.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you've mentioned Hayden a few times, your guitar player. You guys have obviously written a bunch of these songs together, collaborated over the years, just in general. How has that partnership adapted and morphed over these 30 plus years?
Well, we're like brothers, you know. We've lived together on the road for 30 years. We met 33 years ago. And it's like the family history, you know, with my brothers. We don't have to educate each other on our family history. We were there, right? So when it comes to our life in this business and the body of work, there's a shorthand there. Not much needs to be said. I mean, if we started writing a song that sounded like another song we'd already written, we wouldn't have to say it unless it was just like a, you know, oh my, you know, and I caught it before he did or verse, mm-hmm. vice versa. So the other part of that is he's really my band leader. You know, he makes sure that, everybody's, you know, happy. And if there's anything that needs to be brought to my attention, you know, he will, or he'll tell him, you need to go talk to Clint. And, you know, if anything, you know, if I'm seeing something that I think is a problem in the band, you know, I go to Hayden and talk to him first and say, what am I seeing? And why is that? Is it what I think it is? You know, is something wrong with him? Is there anything, you know, and so it's just like, it's, you know, most of those guys have been with me for a long time and including my crew. And so it's like a family, and Hayden and I have managed that together for all these years. So aside from even the writing and the work and, you know, the musical stuff, you know, just making sure we have a happy, healthy, you know, family out on the road, you know, that's something that we've done together that I rely on him greatly, for, and, you know, including my own faults and flaws. You know, I need to be careful about everybody's feelings or what their needs are, if I'm telling them enough or whatever. And, you know, we just manage that together all this time. And so there's something that comes out of that that's, you know, you can't really say anything. It's like a brother, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I like the, you know, you say in the shorthand, like it, that's,
yeah,
when you get to a point like that with somebody, you know, it's just, I don't know, that's where the magic is, you know? And, now like from like, an outside perspective, I guess like where, you know, you read about Clint Black and you read about how you and Hayden, meet and he becomes your guitar player. And that's where really things just kind of click. Did it feel like it clicked in the moment? Like that was just, we're on to something now, or did it feel any different in the moment, I guess is what I'm asking.
In the moment, it was clear to me instantly, wow, that guy on guitar, good Lord, you know, he's amazing. And I'm going to, you know, talk to him more, because I just hired this band to to back me on one gig I needed to do in order to get a bunch of solo gigs out of this country club. Now, solo gigs were going to pay really well, but I wasn't going to get those unless I played this banquet for this guy, booking him. And he wanted me to have a band. So I found a band. He was filling in for the guitar player that had just quit the band. And so I knew instantly I'm going to talk to that guy more, you know. And so he and I gravitated toward each other. And what are you doing? What are you doing? And I was trying to make demos with no money. And he had an 8-track recorder in his garage. So we struck a deal to record those demos. Yeah, it was just instantly clear. This is how I'm going to find a manager, you know, with these demos. And then when he said, "Oh, I write too," and he played me a musical thing, and I had just written a lyric the night before, I had no music for, and I said, "Play it again," and he played it again. And when he did, I sang "Straight from the Factory, We Were Made for Each Other," one of those things that's meant to be, straight from the factory, nothing less than exactly, you're the only lock just made to fit my key. And it was like they fit. They just fit perfectly, mm-hmm. like a lock and a key. And we both were looking at each other going, well, let's write that. So we wrote that, and then we started scheduling time to write and work on demos. And we first song that we finished demoing was Nobody's Home. I found a manager. I knew he was a big-time manager and that I was about to get a break. And so we started writing more. We wrote Better Man, and Killing Time came later, right before we went in to cut, I think, the last tracks on that album. But we had written Walking Away and some of the other songs on there and some that would come later. And yeah, it was clear. This is really, really working. And, I really believe we're doing something here that people are going to like.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Well, it felt like you guys pulled so much out of each other. Like the tone of the guitars just really played well with your vocals and vice versa. And then you guys just were able to really, echo what the words were saying in a song. And I don't know, like, it just felt like there's just some magic was created in those moments.
Yeah. And, you know, Hayden, you know, never ran out of ideas. You know, I always had a real clear sense of, what I liked and didn't like. And, you know, so I really learned the art of recording a demo with 8 tracks, you know, and making the most of that. I learned that from Hayden. And then I started to learn, you know, from James Stroud and, you know, and then, you know, as we started making the record, you know, I didn't always know the right language at the time, but I knew what I was liking and what I wasn't liking. Hayden had a library of things that he knew that guitar players had done for the last 50 years. And you know, so if I was saying, you know, it's not working, you know, I really want something that's a little more swimmy, or, I mean, I may use some, you know, line like that, you know, and he would come up with some way to translate that into something he could do. It was his idea, to use the Jerry Jones 6-string bass for Killing Time. He came up with that, and that was just like, wow, that really adds a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he, you know, years later would say to me, you know, with your style of finger picking on acoustic, you really could play electric guitar and do some of this type of stuff. And he did some lick, and then I laughed and I said, no, I couldn't, there's no way. And he goes, yeah, you could, you know, look, here, just do this one step at a time. And he taught me some licks to practice on, and that really launched me into all of the guitar stuff I did on No Time to Kill. You know, I played almost all the electric guitars on that album, and that was really Hayden, you know, one day when we were songwriting and took a break for a minute to let our brains rest, and he pushed me into that and said, you know, you could do this, you know, you've got a style on acoustic, it would translate, you know, onto the electric really well. And then all these years later, I'm playing stuff on electric guitar that I wouldn't have thought, you know, I never set out to do it. I always just was singing and, you know, trying to play well enough to accompany myself on acoustic.
Yeah. Yeah. Opening the other creative outlets, I guess. Right. You know, one of the things also like that I've always, I guess, noticed in your career is the, yeah, you're writing all these songs, you're writing a lot with Hayden, but then also, you know, you have a lot of other collaborations with, you know, like Steve Warner, and you wrote a few songs with Merle Haggard. What were, in those moments, like when you were writing with, you know, people that were not with you from the beginning, or, you know, what did you learn from someone like Merle Haggard?
Well, I most of what I learned from Merle, I learned from playing and singing his songs and listening to him all those years. But a funny thing, you know, it's like, you know, if you ever meet Steve Martin, you'll recognize instantly why he's so popular. You know, it's like mm-hmm. you meet him and you go, God, I get it. You know, he's just, he's Steve Martin, you know, and, there are people like that. And Merle is one of them. And that is, when we were writing, Untangling My Mind, he really had about, it was about half written. There was some gaps in there and all, but, he wrote down what he had and made me a board tape of what he had and gave it to me. And then I worked on it for about 3 days and wrote down the lyrics as I had them now and sent it back to him through his tour manager. And the band and my band and I are sitting in the dressing room. Merle and I are on tour together. And Merle comes in, you know, hey, how you doing? And he puts the lyric sheet down on the coffee table in front of me. And I said, what do you think? And he said, well, he said, just because of one word, I'd have to give it an A-. And I thought, the professor has graded my paper. So I instantly said, what word would you? I knew what it was. I knew what it was because it bothered me too, but I didn't have anything else. And I said, well, what would you have said? And he kind of, I think it felt like it caught him a little off guard, but he said, well, believing. And it was like, God, it's so obvious, you know. It was so obvious that it was perfect. Just like, you know, you learn that's because he's Merle Haggard that he was able to do that, you know. And also that, you know, I felt like the song from what he and I had written, except for that one little spot, was really good, and that he thought so too, you know. Was another one of those, you know, those sort of the verifications, you know, he's Merle Haggard, you know, and I think I know what's good enough for Merle because I know his work inside and out, and I wouldn't have given him that sheet of paper if I didn't think it was good enough. And he verified that for me, and it just sort of becomes this, you know, sort of the professor and the student moment. That I'll never forget. You know, just there's a reason he's Merle Haggard. You know, there's a reason mm-hmm. we love Steve Martin. You know, if you stood around and talked to Haggard for 5 minutes, you know, it would be one of the best 5 minutes of your life. Same with Buck Owens. You know, there's just people out there like that where you go, you know, yep. It's what I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, it has to be like that moment of like, I don't know, like the, yeah, you said, you know, it validates in a lot of ways, right? And it has to be also incredibly humbling to realize, you know, like that, you know, he's a validated your quote unquote, your work, right? Mm-hmm. You got the stamp of approval, but also at the same time, like, you know, well, that means I gotta keep on working at this level. You know, that has to be kind of an amazing feeling.
Yeah. I always felt like, I don't want my work to be judged just by the fans. I don't want it to meet their standards. I want my musical heroes, if they look over at it, to say, that's good work. Mm-hmm. You know, if Don Henley heard one of my songs, you know, I would want it to meet his standards, or James Taylor, or, you know, Willie. So getting a chance to work with someone who has meant so much to me, and do some work that they felt was, you know, even almost complete. It was very, very, very satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, obviously, you know, you've mentioned a whole lot of your heroes on the countryside. Obviously, you mentioned Jimmy Buffett and people like that as well. And you did do some collaborations with people like Bruce Hornsby. Like, people often think of like those kind of guys, like him and Kenny Loggins or Michael McDonald, like those as being in a different world, mm-hmm. musically.
Edgar Winger.
Yeah. What, I guess like what, it doesn't feel like you were ever afraid to, you know, collaborate with those kind of guys who may be, outside the quote unquote country realm.
No, because, I love their music, and I also see the common threads, pardon the pun. Mm-hmm. and I also know that there are a lot of people outside of country music who love country music. I mean, a lot of these rock artists love country music. And so it's just like, you know, comedians, just because you're Jeff Foxworthy, you know, you may love Monty Python, even though, you know, you have this redneck shtick, you know, you could love Monty Python. I love Jeff Foxworthy and Bill Engvall and Larry the Cable Guy. And I love, you know, Eric Idle and Michael Palin and those guys. And so the one thing that I think we all like to do, you know, like Daryl Strawberry, you know, I got to go play some baseball, you know. Well, you're a football player. Yeah, that's right. I love baseball. Mm-hmm. You know, I know, I mean, especially if you take guys like Kenny Loggins and, you know, you look at the old Loggins and Messina stuff, you know, there's stuff in there that's, well, Ann Murray covered a couple of them, but had big country hits on A Love Song and Danny's Song. So the common threads are there. We're all, you know, part of the same fabric, and it really just depends on the individual. Did you hit it off? Did you want to stretch out? I want to stretch out and do something with a rock artist, and the rock artist wants to stretch out and do something country, you know. The Eagles, plenty of their stuff would be right into the 90s country mold.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, so it's a real comfortable fit. It just then comes down to the individual. And there are people who are too weird to, you know, just have coffee with. I just can't relate to this person, you know. I've been around and worked with people where I'm trying to have a conversation and I'm thinking, I don't think we're talking, you know, we're reading from a different book or a different language. And this, you know, this is just, this is really, really difficult, which makes you want to do it more in a one way, you know, I got to figure out how to, you know, how to have this conversation. You know, but when you do make those connections there, where, you both seem to be reading from the same sheet music and, on the same page, it's really exciting and real satisfying.
Yeah. You know, obviously you have this new record coming out this June, Out of Sane. You know, you mentioned working on, I guess, all the other aspects of being a songwriter or an artist, you know, the engineering and the getting to be a better guitar player and getting to be, you know, just all the studio aspects of that, what goes into that too. On this new record right here, what have you, found that you've loved to do most, like as you've picked up all these little pieces and these tools to help become a better, more well-rounded artist?
Well, I'm finding I'm having to resist the urge to put slide guitar on songs now, because I picked up slide guitar on the previous album on purpose and played it on a record for the first time ever. And I love that. I really love it. It's an exciting new instrument kind of. And so I really enjoy that. I really enjoy the process when it gets toward the end of, you know, there's what I call doing mutes. And that is going through and finding the spots where there's too much going on and something has to go. I really like getting to the point where I'm really refining what the band is doing at any given moment in the song. Because we overplay, and especially when we're overdubbing, the idea is to overplay and just have fun and just do everything you could possibly come up with within reason. You know, you don't want to create too much work for me later, but, you know, if it's me playing or somebody overdubbing fiddle or dobro or something, you know, give me everything you got for a few passes and then let's hone in on the things that are really special and make sure they're just right. And then I'll have all kinds of other stuff. And once I get to a point where I'm now really starting having to decide who in the band is going to be playing at every given moment so that there's no arm wrestling that bothers the ear. That's exciting for me because it's when the real sound and feel of the album starts to take shape. And I really am able to start seeing, you know, hearing what my album is going to sound like, because it's always, almost always an experiment in trying to get what's in my head onto tape. And it'll never be just what I was after. You know, there's happy surprises and there's things I never quite worked out, but this is good too. And so, you know, it's, that's a fun part, but I'd say number one would be, you know, playing the guitar parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this record right here, I've listened through a few times and, you know, I think what's such an important aspect of an artist is when an artist still has something to say. And sometimes, you know, artists can lose that momentum or lose what they, I guess, like they're that guiding light or something like that, or come out of touch with what they're originally were trying to say. And it feels like you still have that, your finger on the pulse, you know, your thumb on the pulse of what you're trying to say. And I don't know. I think that's just, that's obviously a great thing for an artist, you know, to always be able to find that pulse.
Yeah, thanks. I really worried in the early days about going to the well too many times and drying it out, trying to write when I shouldn't be writing. And I decided back then I'm going to truly do this in cycles. So I wouldn't come off of the road with a few days here and there or whatever, and just go write with somebody I would go in cycles because I felt like, or at least I decided that I'm going to go out and live and get input and feed the tank, and then hope that the result is when I go back to the well, there's something there. And I think that, you know, a lot of that comes from being exposed to other art, other writers, other music. Some of it comes from, you know, reading. You know, there's still a lot left to read out there. And some of it is just, you know, taking good care of my brain. You know, I've never had, you know, had an addictive personality. I don't, you know, drink a lot. I don't do any drugs, and, you know, I try to stay, you know, good and healthy and feed my brain. And cause I think that's critical. You know, you have to put stuff into your brain, and then your brain, every time you put something in there, every time you work on a problem, there's physical wiring in the brain. And whenever you're trying to solve a problem, your brain is trying to wire itself to solve that problem for you. And if you'll give it the time, give it some input, it'll do the work. And so the other part of it is, you know, you really do need to know what all has already been said and how it has been said. Otherwise, it's going to be really hard to remain original. Mm-hmm. You know, I try not to ever write a line that's, you know, since we're through, you know, or you broke my heart. I mean, there's just certain things that we heard in the 50s, right? And yeah. Then we heard it in the 60s, and, you know, it was the number one hook in a song. It's okay if it's some line that's buried in there. But if your hook is something that you've heard already too many times, if the basis, the anchor for everything else in the song is something that has already been said that way at least a few times, you know, you're just in trouble. So you have to be aware. You have to be paying attention. If you want to be original, it's the number one piece of advice I give to young artists. Know the music that has already come before you so that you don't rewrite it, you know, mm-hmm. You know, try to make it your own when the rest of us who've already been around for a while listen to it and say, well, you know, I really liked that when the Eagles did it.
You know? Right. Yeah. I'll get you out on this last question. It's kind of one of those things I've always been interested in is, the physical aspect of writing. I guess like how has like technology, changed the way you write a song? I'm assuming, you know, back then you were doing a whole lot of like notebook and pen writing. Yeah. Have you turned over to the laptop or anything like that? Or is it,
yeah.
Do you still like the actual, like,
no, I still use some paper, but the laptop is open and a USB keyboard is attached. Mm-hmm. I will type out lyrics on the screen, but I'll do, something Hayden and I started years ago. You know, we do a bubble sheet, and, it's a creative exercise. Take your central idea, write it down, and then keep expanding and spiraling outward from everything that is related to it that you can think of, so that when you get up, you know, to the bottom of the page or two pages over, and you look at all the bubbles with words in it, they all somehow, no matter how remote they are to the central idea at that point, they all still relate back to that idea somehow. And then you have this sort of a roadmap to the thinking behind your idea and the way your brain looked at it anyway, that you can always glance at. It's always there for you, and you don't have to rethink that. And then it becomes a process of trying to construct the lyrics, and that's when you're you know, just playing the chord progression over and over, working the melody and hoping that words fly out of your mouth, you know, each time you go around. And to help with that, I'll take a USB keyboard and peck out a drum pattern and create a loop so that it's almost like playing with a band. And just, you know, get that tempo right and get that groove right and play along with it and hope that words fly out. And then once the song is there and constructed, it'll take days and days for all of that to sort itself out and become satisfactory. I really carve on the melody, usually right up until the last minute, just to keep trying to carve every bit of originality out of it I can. And so, you know, what was the basic melody at the top, even if it's just okay, but I know I know what I'm going to do with this. Because if I'm co-writing, if I'm writing by myself, I don't even give it a second thought. But if I'm writing with someone else, you know, I'll say, I'm going to keep working on this, you know, and sort of establish an understanding that this is our placeholder and it's only going to get better. Mm-hmm. So if we like it now, you know, it's really good to go, but it's going to get better. And then the lyrics, you know, I will do the same thing with those and all the days coming and continually just try to make sure there's no better way. There's no more original way to say that and keep carving on it. And there are exceptions every now and then, like America, third song on this album, where the album was finished and being mastered. And Steve came over, showed me his new guitar. Steve Warner Gretsch, and I told him the idea I had, and he goes, "Oh, we gotta write that." And I said, "Well, what would we do and musically?" And he goes, "Oh man," and he's had his guitar in his hand, and he just started playing this thing, and I started singing, and next thing you know, we're over in front of my laptop, and I'm typing stuff out, and we aren't even halfway through finishing the song. But I know we're going to get there, and I know where it's going, and it has to be on this album. So while we're writing, I'm texting musicians, checking on avails, texting my production assistant, you know, find out if Ricky's available, you know, and when. And so, and the time it took for us to get to the song being pretty much complete in structure and a couple of gaps, but we'll fill them. We had scheduled a session for 4 days later. And so we got in, got the song cut. I got my vocals down, got background singers in, got my slide guitar part on there, gave it to Ricky to start mixing, and jumped on the bus and hit the road to go play in Kansas. Got to the first gig and bam, the quarantine was here. The lockdown was there. And we didn't have a show that night and got on the bus and turned around and came home. And so then it was just like mix, 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 get this thing finished. My deadline's approaching. I got it in and got it mastered and added to the album on the day of the deadline. And if that had been delayed any more, I wouldn't have made it onto the album. If it had been any slower on getting the recording session done, may not have been able to get the musicians in the room because of the quarantine.
Right. Yeah. It's cutting in those margins, you know, that's just how it.
And that's one of the few exceptions where I didn't chew and chew and chew. And I still did chew on that song because I had a week to 10 days from, from when we started writing it until I had to sing the vocal and commit the lyrics to. There's actually one lyric that when the background singers came over, I had improved on. And before they put their background part on, I ran in there and re-sang the lyric. So it was just the real exception to the amount of time of beating up on the melody and the lyric, and then that slide part, you know, the hook. La, da, 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 da. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, man, that's so simple. Is that really mine? Is that, original enough? It's too simple. But I don't hear anything else when I hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's so. Well, I guess when you get so far into how you were saying just a minute ago about your biggest advice to songwriters is to listen to what's come before you, so you know, it has to be that just as much that when you've recorded a whole lot of music to. Am I not just like copying something else from someone else, but am I copying myself even, you know, that's,
redoing something I've done.
Yeah. What I find probably the most interesting and like telling in all of that is, you learn that having like a filler is okay. And that like, you'll be able to work on that over time and not necessarily
like
where
a placeholder, you mean?
Yeah, like some kind of placeholder. Yeah. Because like even as a writing journalist, I've come to the point where it's like, don't erase anything, just have it in the margins if you need it, or if you up above or whatever, and you can always go back and change that.
Edit yourself.
Yeah. And I feel like that's what I guess like you get it in your head that like all these great artists, they do this in 10 minutes, and that's obviously not the case. It's a very, very few and far between where things come together so quickly. It's a lot of work to get that final product. So it's, I don't know. I think that's very telling. So it's very, reassuring for a lot of people too. So,
yeah, if someone is making something look easy, don't let them fool you. Because that may look easy and it may even be easy, but the work it took to make it easy for them, we all mm-hmm. have to do the work. Yeah. And, especially young kids today, I always said, I wish I could just grab a bus full of, inner city kids or kids, growing up in poverty, and drive them around some of the more affluent neighborhoods and show them and point to these houses and these restaurants, nice restaurants in the neighborhood, and all these businesses that are so well adorned and with stone brick entrances and all of that stuff, where they may come from an area where everything just looks like crap and it's run down and it gives you a feeling of hopelessness, and I want to point at this stuff and say, you can have all of this. Every one of you can have all of this. All you have to do is work your ass off. Mm-hmm. it's like, because none of these people got that by luck. None of these people got that because it just fell into their laps. Nobody out there, with these successful businesses is working less than 18 hours a day. Nobody playing guitar that's just like killing it, got there without practicing for 8 hours a day at least for years and years. And so you can have all of that. You can be great at whatever it is you love to do. All you have to do, and this is the funny part, is work your ass off, and if mm-hmm. everyone really understood that everything, all your dreams are attainable. Now there are people that can throw up roadblocks, but for the most part, you can really reach for the stars and get a hold of one if you just work hard enough. And that's really what it takes. And so anybody that thinks, like I used to think, when I get into the, when I get a record deal and all of that stuff, you know, man, I'll really be able to have the luxury of time to make an album and work on this and spend, you know, years getting this just right. Well, no, you won't, you know, because you're going to be doing 150 shows on the road and they're going to drag you off the road for a quick 3-month production of your next album. And you're not going to have that luxury. You know, you're going to be working too hard and doing all of this other stuff. None of what you see, you know, is easy, no matter who you're looking at. You know, you look at all the big stars on tour, you know, there's not a one of them that isn't working their butt off. There's nobody having success in this business or any other business who isn't working their butt off.
Yeah.
Did I say ass earlier? This is a podcast. They're working their asses off. And that's important for kids to know. Eddie Van Halen didn't just come by those licks. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
you know, if you listen to Hellbent on this record, I figure from the time that we first started playing the track and recording it until the time I delivered it to be mastered, I hit that space bar for listening or recording at least 1,000 times. So what's a 4-minute song times 1,000? That's minimum how many minutes went into just the recording and completion of that one song on this record. You know, it's not construction work. I've done that. I know how much harder it is, but it's hard work. And, you know, I'm glad you touched on that because I think, you know, anyone who's trying to do anything out there, you know, to look over and think that, you know, Hayden Nicholas, you know, playing that guitar. I made a joke one night and after, some song that he had just killed, you know, playing the guitar, and we had a real intimate crowd. And I introduced him. I said, he got really lucky on a bunch of those guitar licks just now, didn't he? know? Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah. Luck. Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where, you know, whenever you, you know, get that record deal or whenever you have that big break, you know, that's not the moment of accomplishment. That's like the beginning almost.
You've been given the big block of granite. Now go to work. It's just now you're gonna start working.
Well, Clint, it's been really, really great talking with you today. We'll have to do this sometime again.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I haven't done a lot of did I lose you?
No, I'm still here.
I haven't done a lot of podcasts, and it's really fun. You know, we can dig deep on this stuff. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's what I love talking with people where, you know, there's not that, like so many people you talk with, you know, they're sitting.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
Yeah, with that radio where it's like, you know, can you introduce the next single? And, you know, you're not even really even able to get deep in the woods there and talk about all the stuff that got you to that point, you know? So that's what I love. And I think people like that too now, you know, it forever, like there is that where you only did listen to those little radio clips or whatever. And that's, that, or like, you know, you saw them in Country Weekly or whatever magazine. And now I think, like, you know, with the podcast setting and being able to really deep dive with artists is it's really, really rewarding on my end. I love talking because at the end of the day, I'm a fan, you know, that's the,
Yeah, we all are. If I could do a podcast with James Taylor, I'd wear him out.
Yeah, well.
Oh, yeah, man. Well, I appreciate your help with the music and all the good things you said.
Okay, thanks for tuning into the Neon Eon. Go give the show a follow on all your favorite social media stuff. Be sure to subscribe, share, and all of the things that sound pretty obvious. All right. I'll see y'all next week here at the Neon Eon.